For the last 50-plus years, air power advocates, and particularly U.S. Air Force personnel, have argued that less restrictions on the bombing of North Vietnam would likely have changed the result of not only the air campaign over Vietnam, but the war itself. It is now taken as fact in many circles that the graduated application of air power, overly restrictive rules of engagement, and micromanagement from Washington were the causes of the Air Force's disappointing performance in the air war. Dr. Brian Lasley, newly appointed command historian at the United States Air Force Academy, recently published Air Power's Lost Cause, The American Air Wars of Vietnam, in which he indicts this line of thinking as Air Power's Lost Cause. Dr. Lasley is my guest on the Air-Minded Podcast. This is the Air-Minded Podcast. Welcome back, listeners, and thanks for tuning in again. I'm your host, the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel. In this episode, I talk to one of, if not my favorite, contemporary air power historians and authors, Dr. Brian Lasley. Dr. Lasley is now the command historian at the United States Air Force Academy, having moved over just this week from NORAD and U.S. Northern Command, where he was the deputy command historian. Brian graduated from the Citadel in 2001 and received a master's from Auburn in 2006, as well as his doctorate in history from Kansas State in 2013. Brian served as a historian on active duty in the United States Air Force, including at the 1st Fighter Wing at Langley Air Force Base, which is where I first got to know Brian. Since leaving active duty, Brian has published three books. The first, The Air Force Way of War, U.S. Tactics and Training After Vietnam, focuses on the revolution in training that happened after Vietnam, in particular focused on the red flag exercises. It is an awesome book. His second book is The Architect of Air Power, General Lawrence Cutter and the Birth of the United States Air Force. And then the third book, the one that he just released, is what I talked about in the intro, Air Power's Lost Cause. In addition, Brian is the editor of the Air Power and Aviation series for University Press of Kentucky, and he's an editor and frequent contributor to BalloonsToDrones.com, which is an excellent online journal and blog site on all things air power and air-minded. He also does a podcast with them as well. In terms of Brian's writing style, it's engaging, it's eminently readable. The Air Force Way of War was included on the U.S. Air Force's Chief of Staff of the Air Force's reading list, as well as the Royal Air Force's Chief of the Air Staff's reading list. I think that's a fate that's likely to be revisited with Air Power's Lost Cause. I think the book is that good. In this book, Brian tackles a massive subject. He sets out to summarize the entirety of the air war in Vietnam, 1965 to 1972, in about 200 pages. It is a tough thing to tackle, but I think he does an excellent job of it. Now, there's a lot, as Brian himself says, a lot of ink has been spilled on Vietnam in general and the air war in particular. But I think this book differs from previous literature in a couple of significant ways. First, Brian splits the air war, and if we were doing this in video, you could see me doing the air quotes, but the air war into multiple different wars, which he says is kind of required for really understanding U.S. air power employment in Southeast Asia. As he puts it, the air war in the North was different and distinct from the air war in the South, which was different and distinct from the air war in Cambodia and Laos. The strategic bombing campaign was an altogether different air war, as was the air campaign waged by the U.S. Navy. And by splitting a single air war into these multiple air wars allows closer examination of each of these individual air campaigns, a look at the context, the successes, the failures of air power, and more importantly, the lessons that we can take out of each of these air campaigns or air wars. It's a unique approach, and I think it really adds to the existing literature on the Vietnam Air War. And second, gets at the title of the book. He coins the term Air Power's Lost Cause to describe the arguments that the disappointing air power performance was due primarily to external factors and not the organizing, training, and equipping of air power or air forces for the air war in Southeast Asia. Lasley indicts this thinking, and he gives many of what he believes are the reasons for the underperformance of U.S. air power in the campaign or the conflict, and what the Air Force and the Navy can and did learn from the conflict. I think it's an excellent book. I really hope you will take a look at it, and I think we're going to see it on multiple reading lists in the next year or so. Anyways, without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Brian Lasley. Welcome. Well, my guest today is noted author and air power historian, Dr. Brian Lasley. He's the command historian at NORAD NORTHCOM. He's just a few days away here from becoming the command historian at the Air Force Academy. I've known him from when we served together in the 1st Fighter Wing at Langley Air Force Base, the bastion of U.S. Air Force fighter aviation. He's a graduate of the Citadel. He has just recently put out his third book, Air Power's Lost Cause, The American Air Wars of Vietnam. It is just as good as the first two. He is one of my absolute favorite air power authors right now. So with, I should also mention, he also does a lot of work for the website Balloons to Drones, editor articles, also does their podcast. So I guess we're rivals in that. Kind of does just a little bit of everything dealing with air power, and certainly one of the air-minded individuals that I interact with a lot on social media. So with that intro, Brian, how you doing?
Hey, great. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm glad you mentioned that our relationship here goes back more than a decade to the 1st Fighter Wing. And I attribute a lot of my air-mindedness to the folks I worked with there, including yourself.
Yeah, so I just went TDY, or temporary duty, to Langley last week, and first time I've left this place for a little bit over a year, and I was struck by all the things at Langley that I loved at the time and you forget about, but simple things like going under the arch, you know, welcome to fighter country, seeing Robin Olds's F4 as you leave the base. There's definitely something about Langley, especially if you haven't been there for a while. It feels like you're coming back, like I said, to the bastion of Air Force fighter aviation.
Yeah, you can absolutely tell. Just in driving around Langley, there's a sense of feeling. You really do get the sense of history there.
Yeah. Took a bunch of pictures. I'm going to put them up, and wanted to do a couple interviews while I was there. Like I said, in the last couple, I've been a little bit overcome by work, but I have had this book in my queue on Amazon for about 6 months, waiting for this thing to come to my door. So first, let me say, when it comes to air power books, I judge a book by its cover. This is a gorgeous cover. I love the cover, probably the best since Munch Fino's book, Tiger Check. This is an awesome looking cover. I did want to ask you a couple of questions about kind of the process, but let's start with you were active duty. So what is your Air Force origin story, and how did you get into the gig that you've got now?
So I did 6 years active duty. I was a logistics officer, an instructor at the now defunct Air and Space Basic Course. For all of you who are of a certain age who remember that particular incarnation of Air Force training, I was a speech writer for a 3-star. And I knew I kind of had a decision point to make at 6 years. For those who have been around a while and remember the riffs, impossible riffs of the mid to late 2000s. You know, I mean, bottom line is I made a decision after talking to my boss that what I wanted to do was go out and go back to grad school. So 6 years active duty, separated, used the GI Bill to go and pay for the PhD at Kansas State University. After doing all of my graduate work there, I was ABD, which is all but dissertation, as they call it. And I needed a job. I had to get paid. And so I started looking around, and it was actually my father-in-law who turned me on to the idea that the Air Force actually had paid historians, right? I had no idea. And so started looking around, applied to 4 or 5 jobs, and was absolutely lucky to get picked up to be the historian at the 1st Fighter Wing.
And I would think that somebody with that kind of background, being at Langley, as we already talked about, would really kind of keep that fire, that passion going. So I did have a couple of questions. So I have talked about on social media, I would love to publish. There's a couple of books that I have banging around the old head here, and maybe when I retire, I will do that. So I'm very interested in the process. So let me start with how do you pick? So I guess we should have mentioned, and I didn't bring them out right now. I know we have the Air Force Way of War, about the origins of Operation Red Flag. I've said in a couple of different forums, I think it is absolutely vital reading to understand my favorite period of Air Force history, which is coming out of Vietnam, which we'll talk about a lot today, kind of the disappointing performance in Vietnam, and then going into Desert Storm. What happened in that 15, 18 years that allowed us to be so much better? you make a pretty persuasive argument that red flag is a major piece of it. Followed that up talking about an air power or an Air Force pioneer that very few people know about. I believe, as I recall, Architect of Air Power.
That is correct.
Man, nailed it. And I didn't even have my books out ready for me. In your books, very, very readable and very quick. I went through this one really quickly as well. So that was a long lead up to the question of how do you pick the subjects that you want to write on? And I understand you got a fourth in the works, so maybe you can give us a little idea what that's going to be.
Yeah, so there, the first three are actually all kind of tied together. So I mentioned coming out of Kansas State and needing a job, and that led me to getting picked up to be the first fighter wing historian. As many of you know, Langley is also the home of Air Combat Command, and it would make sense that they would also be the home of the archives for Tactical Air Command. So I mentioned I was all but dissertation. So that means that I still have to write that mammoth, 300, 400 page paper to be officially conferred the title of Doctor of Philosophy. Well, my initial topic, what I wanted to write about, was actually Walt Disney in World War II. I wanted to look at training films. I wanted to look at Victory Through Air Power. I wanted to look at the Gremlins cartoon he was trying to do with Salvador Dali, or not Dali, Roald Dahl. And so it all, that kind of fell apart, right? I could not get into the Disney archives. And so I was actually over at the Air Combat Command History Office, and I saw a box labeled Red Flag File. So I said, hey, what is this? So I picked those up, and man, from the beginning, from 1975 forward, every after action report done coming out of a red flag was in there. And I had always kind of understood, Vietnam bad, Desert Storm good. And I was vaguely familiar with, hey, we got a lot of new technology after Vietnam, F-15, F-16, F-117, and that all kind of combined to make what we did in Desert Storm possible. But it was through reading those red flag files that I kind of said, hey, no one's ever looked at this training aspect, all right? And so the book, The Air Force Way of War, was actually my dissertation. And I kind of discovered it, by accident at the ACC archives, wrote the dissertation mostly while I was deployed over to Al Udeid in Qatar in 2011, 2012. And then I turned that into The Air Force Way of War, which was my first book. Second book, Architect of Air Power, I did simply because I wanted to do. Lawrence Cutter was a name that I saw a lot of places, a lot of streets named after him. He would show up in books from, pre-World War II, almost to Vietnam, but only ever like a name, like mentioned here, mentioned there, and never more than a page. So I kind of said, who was this guy? What was he all about? And so I did that book simply because I wanted to write about Lawrence Cutter. It turns out I was correct in my guess that I was indeed the only person who cared about Lawrence Cutter, and my sales figures represented that. But I must have been doing something right.
For the record, I've got mine somewhere over there on the shelf. So you got me. I may have been the one, but no.
Well, if we've got time for a quick aside. So obviously, sure. Look, you get into this game for the money, right? For those fat royalty checks. They come once a year. You can take your family out to a nice pizza dinner. But when my first royalty check for Architect of Air Power came in, I had sold a grand total of negative 35 copies. And I was to learn that what happens is Amazon will buy up a bunch of copies, and then what they don't sell, they return to the publisher. So the first year I sold a grand total of negative 35, and I was really worried that I was going to owe the press money. Like I was going to have to write a check for all this hard work. It doesn't quite work that way. Everything turned out okay. But yeah, so the Cutter book I did because I wanted to do. Now you talk about the process. So it turns out after you've done a book or two, after you've proven to various presses that you have the ability, to research, to write, not only that, but to go through the year-long process of actually turning it into a book, copy editing, all of the things, formatting, all of those various things that go into actually turning it into a book, it turns out that presses will start seeking you out and asking you if you want to do different projects. And so Roman and Littlefield, who Air Power's Lost Cause is the press, came to me. I happen to know the series editors in this case, and they asked me if I would like to write on Vietnam. And I was kind of, you know, a little bit cocky, too big for my britches at this point. I think, yeah, I can do this. I can write about Vietnam. This has got to be easy. I will make sense of Vietnam, was my going in.
So if I can ask a question there. So there's a ton, and I think you talk about how there's a lot of ink spilled on Vietnam. You did not choose to drill down into one particular subject. You kind of Amanda was asking me about what it was, and I said kind of a survey of the air war broken into a few different parts. Were they the ones that said, hey, you know, a readable book to go over the entirety of the air war? Or did you kind of say, I'm going to do a survey of the air war?
Yeah, I think they had approached me in general terms about doing a book on air power in Vietnam, which is obviously a very broad scope, right? And so I decided that what I was going to do was I was going to take what I call the various air wars. And I got to tip the hat to Mark Klodfelter, because he kind of introduced me to the concept that there was not one air war or one air campaign in Vietnam. Again, look, Vietnam bad, Desert Storm good, if we want to go that route. In Desert Storm, we all know that we've got Instant Thunder, we have one air portion of the overall campaign, we have one air commander, we are going after a series of attainable and achievable goals. Again, none of that present in Vietnam. So I did want to try to link as much as possible the various air campaigns in Vietnam, the various air wars into a cohesive whole. And so that's how the book gets broken up into looking at the air war in South Vietnam, the air war in Laos and Cambodia, the air war in North Vietnam. And then I break out a few other things because I thought they deserve their own chapter in there.
All right. So let's talk about the title. So your argument, I think, works well with Klodfelter's limits of air power. So instead of me talking about it, why don't you talk about what the Lost Cause is? So I think a lot of us are very familiar with the Civil War Lost Cause. I thought it was a nice turn of phrase that you use that for Air Power's Lost Cause in terms of rationalizing disappointing performance in Vietnam. So in your own words, what is Air Power's Lost Cause?
Yeah, so the book really went through two major rewrites. And it was in the second rewrite that I kind of came to the conclusion that I wanted to grasp with these truths, and you can't see me do air quotes, but with these truths that the Air Force came to believe after Vietnam. And obviously, look, as a historian, I enjoy reading other histories that are not my own time period. So I enjoy reading stuff outside of Air Power. And I was going back through Vietnam or a Civil War book called Race and Reunion. And then I was also kind of reading a lot of, you know, Lost Cause ideology and mythology at the time. And so let me break it down. For those that aren't familiar, the Lost Cause ideology came about after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction's era. All right. And so we kind of consider it a trope. And what it is it was a way for Southern apologists to explain why they had lost in the Civil War. And so scholars kind of pick this up, and it helps to explain in larger terms the South's reaction to the Civil War, right? And nowhere are these arguments more apparent than in Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. Sorry. It is probably the greatest piece of Lost Cause ideology out there. Noted author Pat Conroy said, the North won the war, but Margaret Mitchell won the last battle. All right. And so if you're familiar with the tenets of the Lost Cause, you know, the war was not fought over slavery. The Union only won because they had more men. You know, if the South had had this, then they would have won. But it's really kind of bad faith arguments about the Civil War, right? And it is used as a way to explain why the South lost their righteous cause.
And so, as an aside, have you read Robert E. Lee and Me recently?
I actually have it here right now.
I highly, highly recommend it. I'm well wading out of the pool of air-mindedness on recommending that book. But one of the best books I've read in a long time, specific to Lost Cause. He goes off quite a bit on Gone with the Wind. Anyways, I'm sorry to derail you again. You're about to transition into Air Powers, Lost Cause.
Well, I will say, as a Southern gentleman born and bred, I was very familiar with those tenets of Lost Cause ideology, right? I mean, these were the things, like Robert E. Lee and me, that I grew up believing in. So what I wanted to do was I found out that there were two or three historical aspects to the air wars in Vietnam that I just could not rationalize after doing the research. And they kind of centered around, linebacker two ended the war, and that more bombing applied earlier against North Vietnam, more bombing sooner, than the North Vietnamese would have surely surrendered. And so this is how I started to frame the idea of Vietnam being air power's lost cause, that there were things that the Air Force and other air power, the U.S. Navy, U.S. Marine Corps, even the U.S. Army, I talk about them a lot as well, that they came to believe, but in particular, the United States Air Force came to believe after Vietnam, and that these were, again, quote unquote, truths that could not be challenged. In fact, I quote one historian who said that it became an article of faith among many former U.S. military officers that the Vietnam War was lost because of U.S. political leadership using half measures until late 1972. And really, there are book upon book that cite this, right? That if we had just bombed more earlier, we would have won Vietnam.
Yeah. When I talked about this in that air power history course that I taught, I called it the Boyne versus Clodfelter. I mean, Boyne in Beyond the Wild Blue really laid that out. It was one of the first books that I read as a young lieutenant to get kind of a look at the whole Air Force. And I took that as absolute fact, was that handcuffs placed upon air power is the reason why the Air Force didn't win. And then, of course, so into Desert Storm and Instant Thunder, totally bought into an Instant Thunder in 65 to 68. Man, we'd never have to get into linebacker because an Instant Thunder as opposed to a Rolling Thunder would have led to the capitulation, or at least, a piece that we could agree with. Obviously Clodfelter's book is kind of the gold standard in really, taking a machete to that myth. I talk to other folks about it, it still is out there. I think now people have looked at it another way. And I thought you made a really good argument, multiple really good arguments as to why, the Lost Cause, not exactly accurate. We're talking about different wars in 72 than we are in 68. A lot of things had changed. And also we're talking about fighting a conventional conflict in 72, really kind of counterinsurgency 65 to 68. I guess, do you still see it as pervasive, at least tangentially around the service or air power or air-minded folks?
Yeah, it is absolutely still out there. And even among the veterans of the conflict, they kind of split themselves into two camps. So you'll read a lot of memoir and autobiography that mention that had we done more bombing sooner, the war would have been different. But you were starting to see more and more come out where the guys who flew in Vietnam begin to recognize that nothing that we could have done in 65 or 68, short of something ridiculous like dropping nuclear weapons, was going to force North Vietnam to capitulate. Like you said, and like I mentioned in the book, the wars in the mid-60s was very different from the war we were fighting in 1972. And this is not just in Southeast Asia. The geopolitics of the time were vastly different in 1966, 1967 than they were in 1972. The Soviets had kind of given us assurances by the 1970s that, look, you just want to be out of Vietnam. We don't want to deal with it anymore. So you must do what you feel is necessary. I believe that was Molotov, although I could be incorrect there, telling, you know, a U.S. delegation that you have to do what you have to do to get out of Vietnam. So there really wasn't, by 1972, there wasn't the fear of widening the war into a Soviet-U.S. confrontation, which was a very real fear in 66, 67, and on into 68. So again, the most important thing there to remember is that the context of the war is just different.
Yeah, absolutely. So digging into, now that we've 30 minutes in, covered the title and the cover of the book, one of the things that you did, and you gave a nod to Claude Felter on this, is break the war into multiple different wars. And so, as I recall it, South, North, Laos and Cambodia, talked the Navy War, strategic bombing, and aerial combat, air-to-air. I think those are the portions you broke it into. I thought that was really interesting, because you're talking about incredibly different conflicts. Even the South versus the North, one is a close air support fight in the South. Then in the North, you're doing an interdiction campaign. There's different risks. So why do you think it is important that we look at it as the multiple different air wars? Do we get better lessons out of looking at the different types of war we were in?
And this is where I tend to agree with the Vietnam air war historiography. It's just disjointed and complicated. One of the reasons that I break it down into these different air wars is that they're run as different air wars. And I do think I say in the book that if anything could have made a difference in the air power debates of Vietnam, it would have been more centralized control for air power assets. And this is just not, you know, we've got the 7th Air Force in the South. We've got the Strategic Air Command liaison officer, SACLO, who works with 7th Air Force, but SAC retains control of the B-52s. That's kind of an argument everyone understands. But even to the degree that aircraft flying out of Thailand could attack North Vietnam, but could not attack into South Vietnam. So our bases in Thailand could not provide support to operations going on in South Vietnam. Ed Rasmus, who wrote two great books on Vietnam, When Thunder Rolled and Palace Cobra, talks about reading the ROE while he is stationed in Thailand and saying, this doesn't make any sense. I'm an American fighter pilot, but I can't aid American troops on the ground in South Vietnam, who, by the way, aren't we here to help them prepare to kind of stand up for themselves. So it was just disjointed. And so all of these air wars, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, they're all executed and operated as almost individual contests. I throw the U.S. Navy in there because, of course, as we know, we divide North Vietnam up into route packages. And it becomes really clear through going through the archives, both at the Air Force's Air Force Historical Research Agency at Maxwell and the Navy History and Heritage Command Archives at the Navy Yard in D.C., that it seems that the Navy and the Air Force were often at war with each other as often as they war with North Vietnam.
Yeah, a couple, and I'm blanking on the quote, but there was a great quote from, I think it was a pilot about how, after reading, and I can't remember what he was reading, that he wasn't sure whether they were fighting North Vietnam or the Navy. And I totally butchered that quote, but read the book and you'll find it. You mentioned something that really came off as a strong theme that I was picking up, especially at the beginning of the book, which is unity of command. And that there is no overall, what we would now know as a joint force or a combined force air component commander. So Navy's off doing their thing in their portion of Route PAC 6 and the routes, the RPs that they were assigned. Air Force is doing theirs. You've got SAC. You've got no one person that is in control of air power. And as I kind of came away from this, I like to think about things that we made big improvements by Desert Storm. And I often don't bring up the fact that we have that one commander for air power. It seems like maybe you think that's one of the most important things or most important lessons learned. So what do you see as the importance of a single unified commander for air?
So the closest we as the United States came to having a single unified air component commander in Vietnam was whoever was happened to be running 7th Air Force. And so through much of the early stages of the war, that Spike Momeyer, Momeyer goes on to be TAC commander after he leaves Vietnam. He helps to start the training revolution. But Momeyer and his followers on, if you will, all recognize that there should be a single entity commander commanding all air power forces in Vietnam. And they never got there. They never got there for a couple of reasons. One was Strategic Air Command was not going to relinquish control of the B-52s to a tactical air commander, if you will, in Vietnam. So SAC was going to maintain control of the bombers throughout the conflict. Another reason we never get to the single commander is that the commander of the overall operation in Vietnam, so the commander of the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MACV, is not really interested in the air war going on in the north. So William Westmoreland, and this is by his own admission, saying something along the lines of, I was only tangentially interested in the air war and only in as much as it was important to what was going on in the ground war. So you've got a real problem here in that the overall commander, you know, Westmoreland and then later Abrams were not thoroughly convinced in the efficacy of air power, if you will. And so that kind of hindered Momeyer and the other 7th Air Force commanders from ever getting control of all air assets. On top of that, you know, so 7th Air Force can run the air war in the south. They can coordinate with Task Force 77, which is the Navy air arm. They can coordinate with the guys in Thailand. But again, without the ability to really dictate terms, if you will, all of the air operations in Vietnam were going to remain disjointed. So yeah, I really do think that could have made a difference in Vietnam, a single unified air commander. It would have at least given, you know, the line pilots more assurances that there was an overall unity of effort there. But I do think that by the time you get to Desert Storm, it was clear that Schwarzkopf was a believer in what air power could do and absolutely emboldened his air commander, Chuck Horner, to go out and conduct, you know, a unified air campaign, if you will.
Yeah, and Horner talks about both his experience in Vietnam and the need for the unified commander, air component commander in Every Man a Tiger, Clancy's Every Man a Tiger that he co-wrote with Horner. In terms of big themes, so I talked about unity of command. There's one that hurt my soul a little bit. It comes off to me, and I understand it, that the Navy in some ways employed better than the Air Force. And I don't disagree with you. As I was kind of taking notes, Top Gun, and this really hurts my soul, Top Gun outperformed, which was new in 68, 69, but outperformed the Air Force's fighter weapons school in terms of being willing to react to what was happening on the ground. And I think you could make the argument that Top Gun grads were better prepared for the linebacker air campaigns of 72 than fighter weapon school grads. You talk about the Air Force's inability to or unwillingness to put weapon system officers or Rios in the back of the F-4s and just putting a guy in the back, and how that maybe helped the Navy employment a little bit better. Some more realistic training led to better kill ratios, more dissimilar aircraft training, attack aircraft, and really an ethos to go along with that dedicated attack aircraft. All of those things seem to me, as I'm reading Air Force historian Brian Lasley tell us, that we didn't do as well as the Navy. So what do you think in comparing air power employment to the Navy and the Air Force?
So everyone's learning lessons during Vietnam. I think the Navy just gets there faster than the Air Force does. You know, the Navy has the ALT reports, which aid in the creation of Top Gun in 1969. Obviously, the Air Force already had a fighter weapons school, but the Navy was just, you know, I hate to use it, but was just using the OODA loop a little bit faster there, right? They were deciding and acting a little bit quicker than the United States Air Force, if you will. And so the creation of Top Gun, and I think the guys who got the air-to-air kills in 1972, you know, Duke Cunningham, Iris Driscoll, those guys really do point towards Top Gun as being a deciding factor. But, you know, another explanation for why not only the Navy, but the Air Force as well does better in 1972 than they had done earlier in the war is technology had advanced, right? I mean, things like combat tree, identifying friend or foe, all aided in not some of the more ridiculous rules of engagement that you had earlier in the war, which included having to be within visual range and be able to visually identify your target. So it's really hard to kill someone BVR if you are going to make that individual have to first visually identify the aircraft and make sure it's a MiG. So, you know, some of the technological advances by 1972 helped both sides. But the Navy, I think, you know, with regard to Top Gun, did get there faster. And it was really eye-opening to me to see the A6 and later A7 pilots who really considered Vietnam an attack pilots war. So they really did embrace that mission, you know, as opposed to the F-4 pilots and the F-105 pilots who all considered themselves, for the Air Force, who all considered themselves fighter pilots first, right? And they all recognized that they were, you know, kind of jack of all trades, master of none. You know, one day you're on a mid-cap mission, the next day you're on attack a bridge mission. So I don't think that did the Air Force any favors. And I would think the historiography kind of recognizes that as well.
Yeah, really struck by some of the quotes from the A6, A7 pilots about this being an attack pilots war. Not going to get a whole lot of, I think, even thud drivers to say the same thing on the Air Force side. So in a book that covers five different air wars, really all rolled up into one, there's a lot of stories that many of us are familiar with that you cover in not a great detail, I think, because you kind of open our eyes to some other stories we don't hear about, but things like Operation Bolo, some of the laser-guided bomb attacks on bridges. There's a lot of stories that we are at least somewhat familiar with. What are maybe a story or two that you think maybe you brought a little bit more light to? One of the things that I thought about was you point out how the North Vietnamese archives are really tough to get into, and there's not a lot of people who are talking or who are writing about the North Vietnamese perspective. And certainly it seemed like you tried, and you kind of give us the caveat up front, you still don't have the access that you'd want, but you give us a little bit of eyes on that perspective of the war. So what are things that you think a reader who's maybe not as familiar with the Vietnam conflict as we are should take from the book?
So, you know, we've kind of already covered the lost cause aspect of it, and I think I'm adding something to the conversation there. But one of the things I did want to do was cover all aspects of the air wars in Vietnam. All right, and so let's be honest up front. If I'm going to cover everything, I'm not going to be able to go into a lot of things in any great depth. And you know, this is kind of a personal preference for me. Look, most of my books are 250 to 300 pages. I want people to be able to pick them up and read them, and get on to reading whatever they want to next. Right. Same way I approach my own reading. Look, not saying I'm incapable of reading a 500 or 600 page book, relatively proud of the fact that I've read Don Quixote. But look, those things take a very, very long time. So I wanted to say a lot in as little space as possible. And so, yeah, some things just don't get covered as much as I wanted to. You know, mentioning the Royal Australian Air Force that flies missions in Vietnam doesn't get adequate coverage. Some of the stuff in Laos and Cambodia doesn't get adequate coverage. And then things like Ebola, which I think a lot of people are familiar with, get mentioned, but not in any great detail. Things that I discovered that I don't think are as well known. When you look at Operation Linebacker 2, and we lose 16 B-52s, but this is one of those things that ended, if you will, the Vietnam War, or allowed us to get out of the conflict. Well, the North Vietnamese really look at Linebacker 2 as a victory for them. So it's kind of hard. It's a real juxtaposition to think that we consider that it ended the war, but they look at the campaign as a victory for them. In fact, to the degree that it is known as the Dien Binh Phu of the skies, which I thought was really interesting. You know, they shoot down 16 B-52s, but what is not mentioned in a lot of Air Force histories, and I was never able to get a firm number on this, but the Air Force does not count an aircraft that makes it back to base as a combat loss, right? Like, as long as it lands, it was not lost in aerial combat. But there are a number of B-52s that land back at Utapau that never fly again. In fact, there's an entire row of them there in late 1972, early 1973, that will never take to the skies again. So not only do we lose 16 B-52s throughout Linebacker 1 and 2, but a number of others that never fly again. So I thought that was a really interesting aspect of the war.
I was just going to say, I was really struck by that as well. Would not have... I have bought into, I guess, some of the Lost Cause mythology as well, believing that Linebacker 2, I mean, the Christmas bombing campaign is why we were able to get the agreement we got in early 73, right? We won. It is crazy to think, you know, there were powerful motivators for both North Vietnam and the U.S. to sign that agreement. And it maybe is not as clear a victory as we thought. In fact, as you well point out, they see it as a victory for them. And it certainly at least thought provoking and made me think, well, maybe this is not exactly as I've, you know, come to believe.
I think we all kind of grow up in the mentality of reading about, you know, World War One, World War Two, especially World War Two, where there's good guys and bad guys and winners and losers. And if Vietnam and post-Vietnam has taught us anything, is these things are a lot more complicated. The issues of who won and who lost, and even what it means to have a victory are a lot more complicated. Now, I will say with regard to Linebacker 2, and I think this is probably a really important point, if Linebacker 2 did anything, it did ensure that the North Vietnamese, and this was kind of a final sticking point before the Paris Peace Accords, it did ensure that the North Vietnamese released the POWs. And so we are talking 550 plus American aviators and other service members being held in about a dozen prisons in North Vietnam. Now, by 1972, I think they're mostly at the Hanoi Hilton. They'd already kind of crammed them together after the Santé raid. But I do think that if Linebacker 2 did anything, it should absolutely be commended for ensuring the release of those American airmen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing you talk about briefly, but some of the POWs, you throw out a couple of Medal of Honor stories that maybe if I had read before, I certainly didn't pick up on them, and they were kind of unique. I mean, not the standard ones that we've heard. So kind of throughout the book, they're sprinkled in not only, you know, a page or two here on things that we know about, but also a page or two on something that maybe we're not familiar with at all. You did also cover something right there that I wanted to dig into a little bit, which was good and bad, especially in employment in Vietnam. And then, you know, what was victory? And you take, you know, the discussion or at least the quote that many people have used, that we won every battle, but yet still lost the war. And you look at that from an air perspective as well. I think, you know, good point. How successful were we? I think we need to take a really close look at that. And then in terms of some of the things that, you know, we're the good guys, right? But we did also do a lot of things in Cambodia and Laos with some undeclared bombing campaigns. We did, you know, some napalm use, some other herbicides, pesticides that, you know, and defoliation, all kinds of things that you hit on that, boy, different times. So maybe not all great. And at least it, those were some of the stories that stuck with me.
So let's talk about things that Air Power did, you know, uniquely well during Vietnam. Close air support in the South. The United States Air Arms, I fall into the bad habit of often just saying Air Force, which is not fair to our Navy and Marine Corps brethren out there. But you know, that's a historical problem of mine. But close air support. We do close air support really well in South Vietnam. So if you look at Silver Bayonet, which is the larger operation that I Drang is part of. So if you're familiar with We Were Soldiers Once and Young, close air support there. And then throughout the contest in South Vietnam is done really, really well. So everything from I Drang to Khe Sanh to other operations that you may not be as familiar with, you know, Cedar Falls, Junction City, operations in the Iron Triangle, we do close air support really, really well. We do, for the most part, air to air really, really well. Now, I will say that one thing I wanted to bring out is that a lot of the North Vietnamese pilots were really good. You know, if we have to put some type of standard measurement of employment, look, they had more aces than we did. But again, you know, look, they flew until they were shot down or they survived the war, you know, not like our guys that rotated through on Navy or 1 year tours or 100 missions North, however they had to do it. But by and large, we did air to air really well. And we got better at air to air as the war went on. By 1972, with the advent of Top Gun and technological advances, both the Navy and the Air Force were really good at that. Things we did not do as well. And this is in no way the fault of the pilots who flew the missions. I really want to make that abundantly clear. These were guys who went out day in and day out and flew these CAS missions in the South or flew these interdiction missions in Laos and Cambodia or flew against targets in the North. You know, my hat is absolutely off to them for doing that day after day. But things we did not do as well, you know, let's call it as I saw it. Interdiction along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This was not Interstate I-75 running from Michigan to Florida, right? Like you weren't going to be able to hit a couple of key nodes and separate it. In fact, the very idea that it was a trail that you could interdict was kind of a falsehood, right? I mean, it was a series of trails. So interdiction along the Ho Chi Minh Trail was not and did not do what we hoped it would do, which was interdict the flow of supplies. And
I will also put in a little plug there for your talk on Igloo White, or your writing about Igloo White. For those not familiar, kind of an electronic net that we tried to put down, if you will, sensors down to try and drive targeting. Pretty monumental waste of billions of American taxpayer dollars. And I thought you did a pretty good job of describing some of the ridiculousness of Igloo White on that point.
Yeah, one of my all-time favorite things I found in the research was the Vietnamese officer who talked about basically taking radios and playing the sounds of trucks, and they would put these next to the Igloo White sensors, right? So they didn't feel the need to even dismantle the sensors or get rid of them. Sometimes they would just use classic good old military deception and play truck sounds next to these sensors. So we would go out and bomb somewhere where the trucks blatantly or obviously were not. I thought, look, the North Vietnamese were an adaptable enemy, and they adapted very well to some of our technological advancements.
Anything else besides the interdiction campaign, if you will, against the Ho Chi Minh Trail that you think are major areas that historians or people who are looking at the Vietnam War should look at as areas that the U.S. underperformed, U.S. Air Forces?
I would point to the strategic bombing mentality of the second linebacker operation. And this is not something I came up with. I mean, this is relatively well known that SAC more or less dropped the ball during linebacker two. And that was flying the same parameters and the same mission types that they would fly during a nuclear strike. So three B-52s in a V formation, followed, in cells by other B-52s, all flying the same route over the target for the first four or five nights of linebacker two, all making the same post-bomb run turn that also turned their electronic countermeasures away from the ground. Look, SAC learned, right? But not until the B-52 crews were screaming at the top of their lungs on Guam and back at Utapau that something needed to change. So that strict adherence to that SAC mentality was clearly something that we as Air Forces did not do as well. The final thing, and I'll go back to it, command and control. If you start at the top with four or five different air commanders, and that filters down to the unit level of, one reporting to not necessarily all the same person. This means the line pilots can't get together. And this is a big thing, right? I mean, this is something we do after Vietnam, not only at Red Flag, but at other operations where we can debrief together, right? Navy, Air Force, getting in the same room, talking about the good and the bad of air power employment. And this is something that's missing during Vietnam, right? So the inability to have the single air commander at the top meant that down at the wing and unit level, the guys aren't able to talk to each other and maybe make some changes that would be beneficial, right?
Obviously, you wrote a book on Red Flag, but what are major advancements that happened from Vietnam that really set the conditions for the success of Desert Storm?
Yeah. So, look, this is near and dear to my heart. And I do think that Air Power's Lost Cause is maybe now a nice prequel to the Air Force Way of War. They tie together nicely. But it's not just the technological revolution that occurs after Vietnam. And look, you can't underestimate how important that is. The development of the mighty, mighty F-15, the development of the F-16, the stealth revolution, all of that is enormously important. But the way that generation, and this just wasn't the majors and the lieutenant colonels and the captains who flew in Vietnam, but this was, look, the wing commanders and then also the three stars who went on to be four stars, right? Everyone recognized that there needed to be changes made after Vietnam. So off the top of my head, you're going to do the ALT report and the Red Baron report is going to look specifically at air-to-air capability. AIM-VAL and ACE-VAL that come about in the mid-1970s as well. And for those that aren't familiar, the air intercept missile and the air combat evaluation.
I couldn't have gotten there. Nice. Good for you.
I was talking to you worried if I was going to be able to get there and We could just edit out. I'll just say, yeah. Aim foul, eight foul, and keep pressing. But that's, that's beyond the F-15 and F-16 and the Navy's F-14, F-18. Look, you also get new and improved missiles, right? Now, this occurs during Vietnam as well. We go from the AIM-9B, the Bravo model, which, look, could not fire in over a 3G turn. The warhead would lock on it. So you've got a missile that was initially designed to shoot down bombers from the rear. Really, by the time we get out of Vietnam, look, we've already got the Lima and the Mike, so we're getting more all aspect firing out of the missiles at the time. But AIM-VAL, ACE-VAL is going to get us the AIM-120. And then again, I think the training revolution, and I do tend to harp on Red Flag because I've spent so much time working about it, writing about it. But you could go literally around the globe And find other training events that occur between the Air Force and the Navy. You know, Cope Thunder comes to mind. You know, there are dozens of these exercises, these large force employment exercises, where we learn to work together, right? And so coming out of Vietnam, you know, we have the famous 10 mission number that we learn that if a pilot can survive 10 missions, he has an exponentially higher chance of surviving the rest of his combat tour. And so that training revolution, when you combine it with the technological revolution that occurs, so let's say 1975 to 1990, look, what we did to Iraq is evident to all who observed it. But I don't know that there was a country on earth that really could have gone up against the combined air arms of the United States military in the early 90s and stood a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I kind of set you up, like I've talked about my favorite period to talk about, whether or to read about, whether we're talking Red Flag or improvement in the fighter weapons school or development of the aggressors and dissimilar aircraft training, whether it is America's Secret MiG Squadron and the Red Eagles, there's a lot there. One thing that I think that your book really, I think in some ways better than some of the others talks about is some of the leadership. So you read a lot of those books and you think it's just these Iron Majors, these pissed off combat veterans that came back from Vietnam and are like, never again. And certainly there was that. But they had champions at all levels of headquarters Air Force staff, of at the time Tactical Air Command staff. And those general officers experienced it as well as either young general officers or even younger. And they allowed some of these pissed off captains and majors to go run, right? And to give them the top cover. And that's something that Air Force Way of War, I think, really does an even-handed way of showing that it was, there's a lot of a great, really motivated young folks that did it, but they also had protection at higher levels. So I really like that. You know, I think you're absolutely right in that those books The Lost Cause and Air Force Way of War, really a two book set. You should get Amazon to try and bundle those, certainly for the holidays, right? I mean, a great stocking stuffer for any air power aficionado.
Yeah. If you like this, then also read that. I do think I'm going to laugh about this, that the Architect of Air Power, the Lawrence Cuter book, is forever going to be the kind of way outside in the background for readership and sales. But, you know, that was an effort of the heart. But going back to what you said about the general officers, yeah, I really can't say enough about individuals like Spike Momeyer, General Dixon at TAC, later Bill Creech at TAC. These were the four stars who really empowered, you know, the Gail Pecks and the Moody Suitors mm-hmm. to go out there and make the fundamental changes that needed to be made.
All right. Well, I am going to have you on when we talk Red Flag. So I'm booking you for that one. So when we were talking about right at the beginning, how you pick a book, I know you're working on your fourth. We didn't actually get into it. What is the next book we can expect from you?
All right. So hopefully the next book is going to be just a more or less a general history of the United States Air Force. So I wanted to write something that, you know, for air-minded individuals like you and I could, again, pick up a 250-page book and hand it to our friends and say, here is the history of the Air Force. At least it is the history of the Air Force as I found it. Hopefully that will be coming out next year. It's complete. It's with the press. We'll see what happens from there. But I will also give a plug that I have started work on a fifth book, and I'm finally going back to that dissertation that never was, and I'm beginning
Disney
work.
One?
I'm beginning work on the air-mindedness of Walt Disney. So I'm going to look at Victory Through Air Power, the Gremlins, some of the training films. And then he employed a lot of, look, in the 40s and 50s, everyone was a veteran, but he employed a lot of aircraft manufacturer and former bomber types to help build Disneyland too. So I haven't got a grasp on it yet, but definitely looking at the air-mindedness of Walt Disney.
Yeah. I served in a unit, one of two that is still allowed to use a Disney design. The 19th Weapon Squadron uses a Disney design. His designs are fantastic. There's some beautiful coffee table books that show some of the unit logos and insignias that he did. Really interested. Love Disney. Love Air Power. I think that will be awesome. I'm really intrigued on book number four. I have been pushing Boyne's Beyond the Wild Blue as the textbook, but not the most readable of texts. So something that's about half the size of Boyne's book and kind of covers the surface to get people interested, maybe reading a little bit more, maybe the gateway drug of Air Power history. I'm all in. You got me interested on that one. All right, Brian, I'm going to let you go. Is there anything else that you want prospective buyers of Air Power's Lost Cause to know about this book?
No, look, go out, buy the book, get in touch with me. I got a website. I'm on Twitter. I really enjoy being accessible. I love seeing pictures of the book out there in the wild. It is a huge moment for me when I can interact with people who have read the book. So go out there, buy it, get in touch, and let's chat about it.
That sounds great. Hey, Brian, thanks a lot.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Dr. Brian Lasley, and I hope you'll consider picking up Brian's latest, Air Power's Lost Cause. Or either of his first couple of books, The Air Force Way of War and The Architect of Air Power. Let's go ahead and try and drive up his 2021 royalty checks. Thanks for being patient with me. I know the throughput of the podcast is way down. I'm down to about an episode a month. As I mentioned in a couple of previous episodes, I am in Squadron Command. I'm getting pretty close to the end here, just a couple of more months. And as I've been trying to tie a bow on things and finish things up, I've not been able to dedicate as much time to the podcast as I'd like. But I hope over the summer and then in my next year, as I'm in school, I'll find a little bit more time to increase the throughput of these and get more episodes out there. In the meantime, I hope you'll subscribe. That's a tough word. I hope you'll subscribe and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. You can reach me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com. I'm also try to be active on social media at airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. As always, got to give the legalese, the opinions expressed on this podcast are mine alone and do not necessarily represent the official position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. Until next time, this is the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off and saying I hope you'll tune in next time.